this is Stephen Solomon, and he's one of WHO's lawyers. Stephen's got a stellar track of working on international health agreements, including influenza pandemic preparedness framework, or tobacco control treaty, and many more. Stephen is best placed to explain the legalities of the pandemic accord. So, let's begin.
Okay, great. Ready? Thanks. All right, here are some quotes for you to check out and tell our viewers what you think about it.
Okay, thank you.
The WHO are introducing a pandemic treaty that will mean they'll be able to take your tax dollars without listening to your opinion or giving you the chance to vote on it. Is that democracy?
Okay, this is interesting. Thank you. So there's no taxation in the treaty. The WHO is an intergovernmental organization. It doesn't tax. Only countries have the power to tax. But I think it's also important to say, and Russell Brand makes a very important point here, question is, who decides? He often asks that question. In this case, it is countries that will decide. So the treaty aims to do three things: better preparedness for pandemics, better prevention of pandemics from starting in the first place, and when they hit, a better, fairer public health response to those pandemics. And at the same time, making sure that countries which are in the driver's seat and are in the driver's seat for writing it, remain in the driver's seat for all of those things. Okay, next video.
They want to give themselves surveillance power, determine treatments, vaccine mandates, vaccine distribution, vaccine intellectual property and profits, and they want to redistribute basically everything in the name of pandemics.
So first of all, surveillance power. The treaty won't give surveillance power to WHO. What it would do, the treaty hopes to do, is to make surveillance, public health surveillance, faster, better, more reliable. Also, the treaty isn't going to give WHO power to dictate vaccine mandates. The treaty won't give WHO as an organization, as a staff, the power to dictate anything. And it's important because WHO provides an independent voice, independent of any particular country, independent of any particular interest group. And so recommendations from us, which are based on science and evidence, offer countries a tool if they want to use it to help their response.
But the fact is that this rhetoric around we want a cohesive global response, that's all well and good, but you have to ensure that those kind of ideas aren't subject to potential corruption.
So Russell Brand puts his finger on a critical issue. One of the tools which WHO has, which is really important in this, and was invented by WHO, by the countries in WHO before the pandemic, is something with a long title. It's called the Framework for Engagement with Non-State Actors. Short title is FENSA. And what FENSA is basically, it's a fence against conflict of interest. So we have ways of engaging with all these external actors, which may have an interest in what we're doing to reduce, hopefully eliminate, conflicts of interest.
You know, it kind of sounds all well and good, but is it? We'll find out in just a moment. Good evening, everyone. I'm Joyce Kamen, Vice President of Public Information for the FLCCC, sitting in once more for Betsy, who is still recovering from eye surgery. It's been a slow go for Bets, but we are hopeful she will be back with us next week. We are all thinking of you, Bets. You might want to say hello to her in the chat. Feel free to do that. Okay, so here's what we know. In less than 2 months, 194 member states of the World Health Organization, the WHO, are due to vote on two documents, a pandemic agreement and amendments to the international health regulations. Just so you know, these are legal agreements made between the member states that are binding. And of course, the US is a member state. So what is at stake? And why should you care? What is at stake are the real consequences for human health and human rights. Proposed amendments to the international health regulations are being hurriedly developed owing to, they say, an ever-increasing urgency to mitigate coming pandemic risks. And you should care because the scope of these amendments may, according to some observers, be based upon questionable evidence. So it should go without saying that the only imperative in this is that the evidence is beyond question, and any interpretation of it is well judged and impartial. As you can imagine, this carries immense repercussions for global health. All of this is happening, and here we are, less than 2 months from the vote. So questions remain. What is the quality of the evidence base that gives credence to the supposition that future natural pandemics present global health burdens and that they will, as a matter of course, multiply in both severity and frequency? And is the course of the Pandemic Prevention Preparedness and Response, PPPR, policy aligned with real risks? Last week, as many of you know, legislation regarding the WHO passed in the Louisiana Senate. Tonight, we will learn more about how states can challenge WHO jurisdiction and what's at stake if they don't. Joining our Dr. Pierre Corey tonight is Louisiana State Representative Kathy Edmonston and two of our FLCCC All-Stars that we're always thrilled to welcome back, Dr. Meryl Nass and Dr. Kat Lindley. Welcome to one and all.
Hey, thanks for Pierre. Having us back.
Yeah, Meryl. Hey, Kat. Good to have you guys back.
I think Kathy might be a little late, correct?
Yeah.
They're having some storms in Louisiana.
Hopefully she'll join us soon, but yeah, Meryl, Kat, seems like the clock is ticking for this thing that's coming at us from the WHO, and I can tell you our listeners and followers want to know what's coming, want to hear what you guys are doing. You guys have been amazing. I don't want to swear too much, but you guys are badasses. You're like single-handedly taking on the global totalitarian organization. And so why don't you guys take it away and let us know what's happening, what you're doing, and what we should be doing. What's our call to action?
Well, I guess.
Go ahead, Meryl.
Okay. This is the FLCCC, and we're supposed to talk about science and evidence. But what I need to say, and Joyce said things so well in such a measured tone, is this is not more of the same. This is not legalese. There are very rich, powerful people who have been plotting for a long time to try to gain as much power and money and control of the world as they can. They are going for global one world government, and they're using the WHO to do that. And that's what these two treaties, these two legal documents are about. It's about legally putting everybody else's neck in a noose under the WHO Director General. And that's probably why the WHO has, for the first time in its 75-year history, a non-physician, a guy who was number three in a party that was considered terrorist by the State Department, you know, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who is a buddy of Bill Gates and a buddy of Xi Jinping. And anyway, the fellow you saw in the video is the principal lawyer for the WHO, Steve Solomon, and he looks very cute. And the young lady there was cute, and the video is cute. He's not cute. This is a guy who's working on the language to make sure they can put the noose around our necks. And almost every word out of his mouth was a lie. So I'm going to stop for a moment, let Kat talk, and I'll come back in a bit.
I think what's important to realize is the language that they use. You know, he kept on saying the treaty will not do this, the treaty will not do that. And if you read the treaty, maybe it's not going to do all those things, but what we have to realize is that the treaty does not exist by itself. There are international health regulations that are being negotiated at the same time, and they work hand in hand with the treaty. So many of the things that he said will not happen will happen because of the articles in the international health regulation. And I think that's really important to say. Because if you listen to Tedros, his favorite thing is to say pandemic treaty will not affect the sovereignty. By itself, questionable. But if you read the Article 18 of the Amendments to International Health Regulation, which we will talk about a little bit later, yes, it will affect not only national sovereignty, but also our own sovereignty, personal sovereignty, and the patient-physician relationship.
That's so helpful, Kat, because I try to follow your guys' work, and it sounds willful, right? The fact that they're coming at us two ways, that they're going to be interlocking, and when you have both passed, their summative powers are going to be incredible. But they'll pretend that one's more benign and this one's benign, but literally they're coming at us two ways, and if they succeed in both, they're going to have powers way more than is described in one or the other. Is that correct?
That is correct. But even beyond that, what he said was mostly a lie, if not completely. So what he said was this is about preventing pandemics. Actually, nobody has any idea how to prevent a pandemic.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're not doing anything to prevent anything. In fact, what they're doing is trying to enhance the possibility of pandemics by encouraging nations to go out and find the agents that can cause pandemics and then share them with the WHO and share them with whoever they want to. And the WHO is going to share them with pharmaceutical companies, universities, research centers, and whoever they like. And the only caveat to who won't get these biological warfare agents is the WHO promised not to share them with violence elements. So, hello, you know, is that going to make us safe? And by encouraging nations to come up with more and more of them, because they're going to be paid off for them, they're basically encouraging nations to do the gain of function research and create more of them. Because they're going
to just like to jump in here and welcome Kathy Edmonston, who has joined the conversation. So Kathy, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here. I'm sorry I only have a few minutes, but we're in session. And so I stepped out to talk with you, but I'm glad to be on.
Kathy, it's so nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us. Since you have limited time, this may be a little disjointed, but I think Meryl and Kat kind of laid the kind of the framework of what we're up against. But you're a state legislator in Louisiana, and as I understand it, you just got legislation passed trying to resist this overreach by the WHO. Can you talk more about your work and what you're trying to do? And really what I want to hear is how strong do you think this legislation will be in protecting the influence of the WHO and how we manage our health, our lives, and future pandemics?
Well, Senate Bill 133 was proposed by Senator Thomas Presley. I'm co-authoring, and Senator Valerie Hodges is co-authoring. It's only halfway through the process. It went through the Senate committee, and then it went on the Senate floor unopposed in committee and unopposed on the Senate floor, which was kind of a miracle because I really don't know how that happened.
Unopposed means a unanimous vote?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So now it goes to the House committee, and then if it passes the House committee, it goes on the floor. And then, of course, our wonderful new governor, Jeff Landry, will certainly sign it into law. So hasn't been assigned yet to the House committee, but that'll probably happen next week, I'm thinking. And then hopefully in the next couple of weeks after that, it will be signed into law. So we're certainly hoping. Yes, I do think it'll make a difference. And I think we're going to be the only state, if we pass it, or the first state to do this, if I'm not mistaken.
I was about to ask you that. Is there other states that have passed similar or do you know of other bills in other states that are kind of moving along on this same issue?
I think that there are some other states that are trying to move it along, but no other state has completed the process that I know of.
Gotcha. And so what is the legislation? What is the language of the legislation? What does it profess to try to do?
It just restricts the World Health Organization, the United Nations, and the World Economic Forum from having any jurisdiction in the state of Louisiana. It's very simple. One paragraph. Just done. That's it.
So, Kathy, but what does that mean practically? So that's language. But let's say we're in a pandemic and there's fear mongering. Everybody's worried they're going to get sick. And they, you know, WHO starts putting out, you should do that. Let's say, just for example, you should lock down, you should wear a mask, you should do this, we should shut down these things.
Just like the last 3 years that they tried to do.
Something like that, right? And so in this next scenario, with this legislation, do you think that will literally influence the Louisiana public health agencies, like the Department of Health in Louisiana, from following? Because I find most people are lemmings, they're robots. WHO says this, let's do that. Like, do you think this will remind them that you do not have to follow WHO? Will this result in pragmatic, real differences in how public health is managed in this next pandemic?
Yes, sir. I believe it will, because it will be in the law. It will be against the law to do it. So I think there was no other way but to put it in statute. And I think if we're going to do that and it's going to become the law of Louisiana, then I think it will have a great impact. And right. I think this really, you know, just really sort of supports the people that believe that we shouldn't have done this in the first place, shut down businesses, shut down schools, masked up, all of those things. I think it will empower them to whoever says you're going to do something, you know, we have it in law, but we also have people that are empowered not to do it.
I love that. How unique or significant do you think it is that it passed through the Senate unopposed?
I thought it was a miracle, honestly. I never dreamed that would happen, nor did anybody else.
That is a really loud message from one state, from a whole body of legislators.
Everybody in the Senate voting for it, that just really speaks volumes to me.
Absolutely. And I had heard maybe Kat and Merrill, maybe Kathy. I had thought I'd heard something Montana was doing something. They'd proposed something some time ago. Maybe it hasn't progressed as far as you guys have, but there are other states with similar. And Merrill, this is part of your work. By the way, Merrill, I'm watching you. You're literally globetrotting across Europe, landing in parliaments and legislators, bringing attention to parliamentarians like, hey, watch out, this is coming. They're coming after each country. So you're doing global European stuff all around the world. And now you're trying to go state by state. You have a call to action for state legislators to do what Kathy and her colleagues have done. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. So I think the bill in Louisiana is essentially a perfect bill. It doesn't waste any language, no whereases, nothing to disagree with. It just says we should have the right, you know, essentially based on the 10th Amendment, to govern ourselves as far as healthcare goes and as far as other issues that were not enumerated as federal powers. And why should some supranational organization that gets 85% of its budget from private sources, you know, be giving the state of Louisiana or anybody else, you know, orders? And that is what these two treaties propose. Now, what happened in Louisiana is they got 9 Democrats and 28 Republicans to vote in concert. And I think that's because none of the Democrats were willing to vote in favor of letting the World Economic Forum and the WHO, you know, give orders to Louisiana. And I think every other state should have a similar bill. We're not sure about the UN. We think that possibly because the US is already obligated under many treaties to the UN, that may complicate the bill. But definitely, I think the WHO and the World Economic Forum need to be there. Now, there are other states with similar, Alabama copied Louisiana, introduced a virtually identical bill. Tennessee is in the process. Maine tried. We just had a vote today. It went down party lines. And so we lost. The Democrats, are in the majority in the Maine legislature. So we lost that. One state that actually passed a nullification bill at the end of January was Utah. And that essentially does the same thing. It doesn't mention the WHO, but it says we're not going to take orders from outside. We here in the state have authorities, you know, given to us by the Constitution, and we're keeping them. Thank you very much.
Let me jump in here and ask a question of Kathy Edmonston. Kathy, before you leave, we would want to, the viewer wants to know, Judith wants to know how you can utilize Louisiana's precedent most effectively to replicate in every state? But the other part of the question is, does state law override federal law in this case?
Yes, ma'am. I believe it does. I believe that we have allowed the federal government to usurp power from the states. And we know that's not what our founders wanted. And I think it's just going to take little steps like we're doing to take it back. I just think we're so used to the federal government just coming in and doing what they want to as we rise up as states and say, you're not going to do this, such as Texas with the border. I just believe that we will really impact our country.
So what does that mean if the WHO considers the United States one of its member states, just one? How's that going to work?
I can't answer.
I can jump in. So
yeah,
a lot of people think that, well, treaties trump domestic law, but it's not that simple. There are different kinds of treaties. The IHR, for example, has never been ratified by the Senate. It is sort of a low-level treaty. These two documents would need some kind of congressional assent in order to be enacted, because they require the United States to pass laws. And if Congress doesn't do that, it doesn't have even that much authority. But the thing is, it's not a question of trumping state law. It's a question of, does the treaty trump the Constitution? And that is not the case. So the Constitution is basically the highest echelon of law in the United States. And we're talking about the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. This is just state law that is asserting that that the state is going to obey the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. It's not making new law.
That's right. And also, I see it in the notes here, and I know that lady that just asked me the question, I'm sorry, I don't know who it was.
I'm Joyce. I'm sitting in for Betsy tonight.
Hey, thank you. You asked what we could do to impact other states. We'll be glad to send you our legislation. If anyone wants to reach out to me and my email, whoever initiated this call has my email, and we'll be glad to send that to you, as you ask for it. Also, I see on here about an ivermectin bill. We're getting ready to hear that. I should be in there listening for it right now. We passed a committee, and it's going to be on the floor in just a few minutes. So I really am going to have to go, but I thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much. Real quick, the ivermectin bill, is that for over-the-counter, or what is that bill?
Yes, it's for the ivermectin becoming over-the-counter. That's
like
correct.
Like Tennessee. Let's go.
Yeah. Okay. Thank y'all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that miracle.
Yes, thanks, ma'am.
She has tried to pass a bill like this before. And so she has been on this for more than a year, maybe a couple of years.
That's correct.
Finally, session.
And so we're doing it again this time, and it's going to get through. So that's going to be good.
It's interesting that the way you guys said it, like, I don't know if it was Kathy, but like, so 8 Democrats, right, in the Senate in Louisiana, they were like, they're not going to vote for, the intrusion or incursion of WHO. But in Maine, the Democrats were like, no, we want WHO, right? Is that kind of how it's playing out? I mean, this is regional nonsense.
Yes. I mean, Maine is, all 3 branches of government are run by the Democrats. It's a very, the members and senators are made to go along. They're not given any autonomy. And the bill came in late. And so there wasn't enough time to, the session is about to closes in a week. So wasn't enough time to really talk it up and make people understand what the ramifications of it were.
Meryl, I have a kind of a political geeky question. United States regulation of medical care is relegated to the states, right? So we have a federal and state governments here. In Europe and other places, are there other countries with similar where healthcare is regulated at the state and regional level, or is it most of them kind of federally regulated?
So Wolfgang Wodarg, who, as well as being a physician, was a member of the Bundestag and of the European Parliament and of the Council of Europe, has told me that, in fact, Germany has 16 essentially states. I don't know what they're called in German. Right. And each has its own parliament, and they could do the same thing that the states are doing here. Some okay. people have suggested that Canada can do that as well. So I think it's up to people in these countries to figure it out.
The reason why I ask is I remember in a lot of my travels, when I was lecturing in France and I talked to all the doctors persecuted there, and I asked them, I said, you know, in the U.S., we'd had different regions which had some resistance to this public health over, like Florida did its own thing, Texas did some things, you know, some other states. And I said, is there any region in France that was, a force of resistance? And they were like, no, all of
Marseille.
Well, that's, yeah, sort of. That's where I was, Meryl. There was a little outpost of resistance, but not the whole region. But anyway, yeah, I just wanted to know.
Let me throw in a question here from Laura Emerson. She wants to know if you can talk about how the WHO is funded. Is it funded by the member states and also by the pharma companies? And how transparent are its funding sources and its expenditures?
So originally it was funded by the member states, but over the time that changed, and right now over 80% of their funding comes from voluntary contributions. Some of them are from the member states' voluntary contributions, and the others are from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Gavi Alliance, Wellcome Trust. What does that mean? It means that WHO really only has maybe 20% of their budget they have control of. The rest of it comes with earmarks. If someone gives you money, they give it for certain programs, and that's how the money is spent. So that video that we watched at the beginning where he said there is no conflicts of interest, there are conflicts of interest.
Yep.
The conflicts are massive. I mean, so that 75% of the budget is spent on earmarks. So the donors tell the WHO how they want 75% of its total budget spent. And they are not transparent about where that money goes. They keep that hidden. They will tell you who the donors are. I don't think they tell you exactly what percentage each one gives, but they don't want you to know what all their programs are. And they actually have these organizations like Bill and Melinda Gates and Gavi and even pharmaceutical companies. The large international lobbying entity for pharmaceutical companies has been working with the WHO on these documents, because they can't create a document unless that organization agrees with it. And in fact, that organization told them with one of the drafts of the treaty, they'd rather have nothing than to have that treaty.
And let me add one thing to what you guys just said, is that was best, what you guys just said was best illustrated in the documentary called Trust WHO. I think it came out 8 years ago or something, but they literally depict the transformation of WHO. WHO was a really impactful and I think important international public health organization last century, but somehow over the last 23 years, it's been co-opted in the ways that you guys just talked about. And they're not doing public health anymore. They're literally serving the interests of these funders.
Well, it's worse than that now. So they've been serving the interests of the funders. Now they're serving the interests of people who may be interested even in depopulating us, but who are certainly interested in pushing very dangerous treatments and withholding other treatments. So part of the International Health Regulation amendments, amendment number 43.4, says the WHO Director General can tell countries what drugs it has to withhold during a pandemic. Withhold. Yeah.
And then obviously they're going to say what they can use and what they can't use. And the other one of those regulations that I saw is that they literally, and help me out here because I think I'm going to have a seizure, but the WHO will determine what misinformation and disinformation is. So we need to know from, they're going to tell us what to listen to, what to believe, and what not to believe.
No, they're going to tell us what to censor, what you're not allowed to hear.
Right.
Won't have a chance to believe that.
What is your greatest concern about the international health regulations and the evidence they're putting forth for putting these amendments forward? And of course, the time is running short because it looks like this vote is going to happen at the end of May, correct?
For me, it's the never-ending loop of fear. According to them, we're going to have a pandemic after pandemic. The next one is going to be 20 times deadlier than the previous one. And if you read the avian flu, 100 yep. times worse than we are now. So it's going to be this state where they're going to keep on putting us into public health emergencies for them to really regulate the way of life. You know, if you think about it, we're going into next elections in November. Everyone is expecting something to happen. And that's how they're going to control everyone by these new pandemics that Director General himself can declare, even if the country says it is not an emergency. He will have those powers, and then he will lock us down. He will tell us what type of treatment to use. He can order isolations, quarantine. He can limit trade in the area, travel restriction, vaccine passports. You know, start talking about vaccine passports, CBDC, UN Agenda 2030. Hey, we are really close to the social credit score system that they see in China. And these are not conspiracy theories anymore. Everything is written in their documents. Is the life that we, you know, confined life that it's going to be controlled by them.
Indulge my naivete and optimism for a second, but let's say they declare a public health emergency of international concern and they start dictating all these things and they say, hey, there's avian flu going around. It's got 50% mortality, but guess what? We have this awesome new mRNA vaccine that we're recommending to everyone. Based on the uptake of the last booster, and I think how toxic this mRNA platform is to many people in the world, not everyone, do you think this is going to work again? That they can actually successfully execute a global vaccination campaign with an untested experimental vaccine?
Let me give you some bad news. The FDA has already licensed an avian flu vaccine for humans, and it's not mRNA. So they can use that vaccine, or they can use an mRNA vaccine, but that one's got a license.
And I think, Pierre, you have to think about it this way. We all think we're not going to comply. We're smarter. Right. We know the play, right? We know it. But what is the thing that we fear the most? For me, it's my kids. I know it for you, it's your kids.
Yeah.
If they say there is this, you know, something that's going to attack our children and the only way to protect them, you're going to think about it. You're going to think about it. And I think, you know, they realize that they can rule us by fear. It's just important for all of us to stay connected the way we are, discuss these things and actually make a rational decision and not an emotional one.
Well, I'm going to make a little plug here. You know, from studying therapeutics in COVID-19, if you look at c19early.com, we literally have 43 effective antivirals against COVID. Many of them are broadly, they're not virus specific. I just want to make a sober point here, inspirational point, that if the avian flu comes out and they start shoving a vaccine down our throats, you come to the FLCCC, we will come up with a combination synergistic effective protocol that's going to be safer and more effective than that vaccine, period, full stop, end of story.
100%
and
agree.
I will advise people to go to your website and to use that protocol. But they, as they did with hydroxychloroquine and later ivermectin, we may not be able to get any of those medicines. You know, they blew up the second largest hydroxychloroquine factory in the world.
I remember
Meryl,
that.
You're so not.
She's not giving good news. so
she Kelly, just brings us back to reality. You know,
yes. Right? Kelly McGowan, who's watching the program now, wants to know how this bill can stop the U.S. federal government from enacting the WHO dictate. We sort of asked Kathy Edmonston that before, but this is actually coming at it from a little different way. How would this bill stop the U.S. federal government from enacting the WHO dictate? And then she says, for example, what happens when the DHS says you have to have your vax information up to date to board a plane, for example?
Look, Meryl, before you answer that, I just want to make this one comment. I testified for the bill in New Hampshire. The New Hampshire bill had CDC and WHO in it. It is very difficult to get the CDC part passed through Democratic side because many of them still believe that there is a role for these agencies. So I think it's very important, any type of bills that we do try to advocate for, talk more about WHO side. And go ahead, Meryl, if you can explain to them the rest.
So, I mean, a lot of what the WHO is doing is designed to confuse us. But let me try to clarify one thing. This is not it is an evil WHO, but it's not coming from the WHO. This is coming from the globalists who are controlling the Biden administration, you know, who controlled the administration before that, perhaps. We don't know about Trump. He tried to get us out, but then he's never said he made a mistake with the vaccine. You know, he never really made any effort to make ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine more accessible. Certainly, the globalists ran the Obama administration because that's where this whole thing started. This whole biosecurity agenda, well, putting big money into the biosecurity agenda started around 2014, about 10 years ago. What the WHO is doing started when the United States brought forward 13 amendments 2 years ago and said, we want to get these through. We've already got 40 some countries that are in favor. Let's just do it. And when the rest of the world took a look at them, that was the beginnings of this. So they were trying to centralize power in the WHO. The United States government was trying to centralize power in the WHO. How could that be? It doesn't make any sense. It's because the people who owned the US government also thought they owned the WHO, and that this was a mechanism by which they could get all these other countries, you know, rolled into the same program. And so the federal government, you know, loves this. And are negotiating very hard on this. They sent 65 members of the Biden administration to Geneva 2 years ago to try to push those amendments through. They had to drop 8 of them. They got 5 passed. And then they said, well, instead of making this just an American thing, we invite the rest of the world to put forward any amendments you would like as well. So they wound up getting 300 amendments from 90 some countries. And then the WHO put in 7 of their own amendments. And then bureaucrats who are, you know, paid by the WHO and paid by its donors and pharma started working on them. And again, when Steve Solomon said, no, it's the nations, it's only the nations. No, it's not. It's the bureaucracy of the WHO. It's all these stakeholders around the WHO that are really doing most of the work on these documents and making sure that the key issues are not lost in the negotiations, despite the fact we've had 7 or 8 different drafts of the treaty. And those key things are nations must surveil the social media of their citizens and censor them. Nations must put into place the ability to roll out unlicensed drugs and vaccines with no liability for the manufacturer, the government, or the WHO, right?
That's like a PrEP Act globally.
It is exactly like that.
Immunity for all these untested stuff that they want to launch on us, and they have no liability and they can just push them out under like EUAs.
Yes, that's what they want. The WHO will be able to declare a pandemic whenever it wants, and because it's going to require nations to be constantly surveilling for pandemics, you know, sticking swabs down the throats of humans, animals, and wastewater, they can declare a potential pandemic, which is in the documents, the potential for a pandemic, whenever they want. And then they roll out all this stuff. But it gets worse because the pandemic treaty doesn't even require a declaration. It's going to be enforced 24/7. So the globalization of the PrEP Act, that's 24/7. You don't need an emergency. The requirement that nations go out and find pandemic pathogens and share them with the WHO and share them wherever they want, that's 24/7. You don't need a pandemic. So it's very, and you know, and the censorship will be 24/7 also.
Meryl, what, maybe now this is where you guys can speak to your work, but what are the solutions? Like, what can we do to resist this? And I know this is what you're all about. Talk about your organization, Door to Freedom. And I think our followers should understand that your organization is literally at the forefront of trying to do something to mitigate the impact of this and to resist. And so what is your strategy in your organization? What do you think is the best path forward to protect the most amount of people?
Yeah. Okay. And Kat has an organization called the Global Health Project, and both of our organizations are focused on this. So what's the best path forward? Well, first of all, I suspect they won't even vote. They have not voted on prior amendments to the international health regulations. They've had a sort of a bogus process that they call a consensus process in a subcommittee, and then everyone just goes along. It's all done in back rooms. So they figure out how many countries they've got, they bribe, they cajole, maybe they've got the numbers, maybe they don't, you know, and then it's done. So I don't think we're going to see a vote. And I think if we can force a vote and force the nations and the diplomats to actually commit themselves to what they're voting for, I think that's going to be very important. Turns out that the Italian delegate and the Russian delegate were both making statements in these meetings that went against their nation's policies. So it looks like those two people had actually been, you know, whatever, bribed, cajoled, threatened. And so once people were watching videos of some of the meetings and found this out, notified the government. So now those people are in trouble. So that's one thing, you know, are they actually going to have a vote, and will the nations and their diplomats be accountable for the decisions? I think that's really important, because they might not be willing to be accountable if, in fact, this is treasonous, if they are turning over their nation's sovereignty and doing so in such a way that isn't even allowed in their own nation's constitutions. That could be a problem for them. So I think that's one thing. But the other is to realize that, as Kat said, the CBDCs, you know, all the 15-minute cities, the transgender, the pronouns, it's all trying to sort of destroy our culture and society from within and create something that's much more easy for the globalists to control. And so we have to say no on all levels, you know, no. We have a school board. We're not going to allow our children to be taught these things. You know, no, we have an FDA, and they are the only ones that get to say what medicines we can. See, the FDA had a problem during COVID. They had to use stealth. They had to fool people and think hydroxychloroquine was an EUA drug, when in fact it was a fully licensed drug, because once it's licensed, the FDA didn't have a mechanism for stopping people from using it. So they
same
had to use
ivermectin, Meryl, the same deal.
Absolutely, right. And then they tried to control it through the supply chain by making the manufacturers and the distributors hold it back, you know, so, but that's illegal. So they did that. So we have to, you know, legally go after them for the things they do that are illegal. But I think, you know, as the noose tightens, everybody is going to figure out what's going on. And then we're going to have 8 billion people against a few thousand people, and we're going to beat them. They're not going to be able to do, you know, unless we all, you know, jump over the cliff willingly and put our arm out for the untested, unlicensed vaccines, they're not going to be able to pull this off. So the real issue is educating everyone.
Yeah.
And that's what Kat and I are, and that's what you're doing today. You and I'm sorry, Joyce.
Joyce, it's fine. Betsy should be here, and hopefully she'll be back next week. I think we have a slide, Pierre, about the organizations for Kat and here we go. So we have the Global Health Project, the Door to Freedom, and the Sovereignty Coalition. Can you talk about each one of those organizations, Kat?
Before we go there, I just want to say the reason we are where we are is because our federal government has abandoned their duty, and their duty is to protect the American citizens. You know, our constitution, like Meryl said, and there is actually case laws that show that even Supreme Court said that the Supremacy Clause does not supersede constitution when it comes to the First Amendment. There are some cases from 1985, I believe. Our legislators have abandoned their duty, and they keep on saying this is not something that we need to take on. We don't need to worry about it. It's not a big deal. It is a big deal. And it's wonderful to see the states say, no, we're not doing it. We're not having any of it. Each person can do something. And that, you know, those slides that you had, there is the Door to Freedom that has all sorts of documents and flyers that you can print out and take to your legislators And then Sovereignty Coalition has a Align Act. If you sign the Align Act and a couple of different initiatives, it will go directly to your federal legislators, state legislators, and representatives. And then you can take some of these resolutions that have been passed in different caucuses around states, the GOP coalitions and things like that. You can pass them in your own precincts, because we do have election coming up. We need to make this an election issue. Every person that's running for office needs to be asked this question: are you willing to give up the sovereignty of our state and our country to World Health Organization? Are you even aware of it? Most of them are not even aware of it if they're not educated. This is really the future of our children is at stake. You know, CHD just had an article yesterday, I believe, about RSV vaccine and things like that, and we're not going to get into it. But what public health is trying to do now is they want to vaccinate our way out of life. There is something out there. There is a vaccine for that. And this is kind of the way the World Health Organization wants to deal with these things. No, we're going to do the vaccine production. It's good for our partners. It's good for the world. Everyone is going to benefit. And in the meantime, we have people. The World Health Organization has abandoned their duty. They haven't looked at their own safety data to say, and they have plenty of it, to say that the vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine, has affected and destroyed many lives. Their own data says that. WHO is the one that gives us ICD-10 codes. There is no ICD-10 for COVID vaccine injury because they don't care.
Well, Kat, this is
about global control.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah, it doesn't exist.
But yeah. Meryl, going back to like Kathy, who was here from Louisiana, like I saw a document, I think was from your organization, where like you're literally going out there putting a call to action, trying to rally like attorneys general and other legislators, like trying to state by state. So can you tell us, like, give us an update on how much traction you're getting?
Well, I think that 37-0 vote in the Louisiana Senate showed that we are definitely getting some traction. And we had created a model bill that was almost identical to the Louisiana bill earlier, which you can find on my Substack. You can also find the Louisiana bill, and you can find out ours as actually a resolution. But we of course want the states to write whatever language they want. But many of them think this Louisiana language is a winner. We are approaching governors and particularly attorneys general. We found out that 2 years ago, 15 of the U.S. attorneys general actually challenged HHS over its giving authority for the declaration of public health emergencies to the WHO. So it turns out on the last day of the Obama administration, HHS rolled out a new rule that said WHO, you know, can... in three different ways, WHO can declare a public health emergency, and the U.S. will go along with it. And so 15 AGs said, no, you can't do that. You can't do that in our state. This is 2 years ago, and you should rescind that rule. And HHS said no. And then the AGs of Texas and Oklahoma sued HHS. But a judge threw it out, saying your state hasn't suffered yet because they haven't done anything. And HHS said so. We're not really going to use that. But of course, they didn't repeal it either. They left it out there. So that was sort of, you know, a what do they call it? A shot across the bow to see if they could get away with it. So what happened is that these 15 AGs wrote 13 pages that discussed the case law and discussed the Constitution and everything else and explained why the WHO has no authority in the states. And so it's a very good document, and it makes it very easy for attorneys general now to just take the arguments that are in that document and issue them as an opinion. So without really doing any real legal work, they can take that document, they can take a few other articles that have been written and just issue an opinion saying, we don't think, you know, the WHO or the federal government for that matter, or the World Economic Forum has any authority or jurisdiction in our state for health or for information control, which is, Now, Louisiana led the way on information control, too, right? Because it was Louisiana and Missouri that sued over the censorship and the First Amendment. So it was Jeff Landry when he was the Attorney General of Louisiana and Eric Schmidt when he was the Attorney General of Missouri who brought that case against the federal government for overreach on their states, right? So we have some very good precedents of the attorneys general stepping up and asserting their authority. So we would like them to understand that this WHO issue is huge. And I hope that you've got a great audience tonight, about 1,300 people. Call your attorneys general, call your governors, call or write to them, to the members of the legislature, if you still have time in your session, and say, we need to protect the sovereign, the health sovereignty, the information sovereignty of our state, and assert that you're going to protect it, that the governor will protect it. He can just say it. He can issue an executive order. The AG can issue an opinion. The state legislature can do what Louisiana is doing and what other states are trying to do. There are similar but not quite as good bills in about a dozen states now.
And Meryl, so, you know, the 1300 on YouTube, we have Rumble, we have Odyssey. I mean, there's quite a few people who can, if they take your advice, your call to action, I mean, we can make an impact here. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Can I ask a couple of more questions before we have to wrap up for the night? Couple of things. Actually, this one is for you, Pierre. Someone wants to know, you mentioned that the avian flu does not have it's not on an mRNA platform, or I think Dr. Nass did. Anyway, someone wants to know whether an mRNA vaccine will ever be okay to consider.
No. Gene therapies, there's no safety for gene therapies like mRNA platform. There's no way. There's no shutoff valve. I mean, the mRNA vaccine for COVID is the most toxic and lethal intervention in the history of medicine because it makes a spike protein. A spike protein is an insane pathogen. Now, if they have other mRNA vaccines, they might not be as toxic as COVID, but I can't even get into vaccines. I mean, you're still talking about a gene therapy, lipid nanoparticles, distribution across physiologic barriers. You can't control shutoff. You can't control where it distributes. I mean, gene therapy vaccines are insane. And if they, I really think that platform is going to implode. They cannot use that. That's toxic. I'm sure Meryl can have other thoughts on this too, but no way.
Yeah, no, I agree. Certainly, as they, the only way they know how to make them now is it's horrible. It's not possible to make a safe mRNA vaccine. I think, in my opinion, they never should have been able to license this because it is the basis of FDA regulation that you have to know what the dose is when you're giving someone a drug or a vaccine. And when you give the mRNA, you don't know how much they're going to make. I mean, you're giving them a precursor and letting them use that precursor will then employ the body's own machinery to make as much of the product as it wants, the end product,
which
in this case, the spike protein. Well, Meryl, some people aren't going to make much, and some people are going to make a million times that much.
Meryl, let me just interject with some clinical data. I don't want to get too geeky here, but in my practice, we have been using this test called the semi-quantitative spike antibody dilution level. So it's just a measure of spike antibody. It's a really interesting test because it has a reference range from 0 to 25,000. My long COVIDs, they're in the low hundreds to low thousands. My vaccine injured are all through the range. And we have a cohort of patients who have greater than 25,000 spike antibody level 2 years after the vaccine. Why are they so full of spike antibody? I mean, that is an insane platform and technology. And you're absolutely, there's no way to make that safe.
So let me ask the converse of that. What about a non-mRNA vaccine? Are there any non-mRNA vaccines that you would say could be deemed safe?
Before anyone answers, I'm going to say the answer is early treatment. Early, effective, multiple, combination, repurposed, safe, proven, effective, broad antiviral therapies. I'm just going to say that before you answer.
And strengthening the immune system so you don't even get sick, right?
Yes, Kat, thank you. That's even better, Kat.
Look, the only things that are going to really kill you in a pandemic fashion are going to be respiratory viruses, right? Because the other illnesses, like the Black Death, you know, you have to get close to someone. You know, we can, I mean, you don't have to, they can't spread wildly like a respiratory virus. So I think respiratory viruses are the only thing we need to worry about. You're never going to be able to solve them with vaccines because it takes too long to make a vaccine and test it. We actually do not have a recipe for making vaccines in general. The vaccine against every microorganism is unique, you know, and it's a trial and error thing. So making vaccines is, somebody said about 30 years ago, and it's still correct, that it's sort of an ancient art. It's not a science. You just create antigens or you create, you can create all sorts of things, but you create something and you test it in animals. And if it doesn't kill them, then you test it in bigger animals. And then if it, you know, doesn't kill them and you think it might work, you test it in people with cancer or people who are really sick and dying. And if it seems like they're making antibodies, then you try to see if it actually works. And usually it doesn't. So the vast majority of vaccines fail in this process of a preclinical, which means animal, and then human testing. Most fail. What they did with these mRNA vaccines and the DNA vaccines, because there were two of those, is every vaccine, and there was also Novavax, every vaccine that started, they allowed in. So they authorized, not all, AstraZeneca wasn't authorized in the US, but it was in Europe. They authorized every one of the vaccines that were just at the starting point of this process. And they never proved that any of them were safe or effective. So if you're going to do that, you can roll them out fast. It still took over 300 days for the quickest one, which was the Pfizer in the US. The plan is they want to roll them out in 130 days. There's no way you can test them. If you can't test them, there's no way you'll know whether they're effective or safe. So what they want to do is produce products, make a lot of money, roll them out, and it's unlikely they're going to be safe or effective.
Wow. One last question. There was a claim, and I think this is from Ellen for you, Dr. Nass. There was a claim early in COVID that people who needed hydroxychloroquine, like for autoimmune diseases, were not able to get it because people were stocking up for COVID. This sounds to Ellen like media lies. Is there proof of how this claim originated that can be shown to be false?
Meryl, can I try to answer that? Because, and then I want you to answer, because this is my understanding. I'm not the expert. But from what I understand, hydroxychloroquine is absurdly easy to manufacture. You could make millions of tablets very quickly. But as you mentioned before, one of those factories went down. But this restriction of a very easy to manufacture at high volume tablet is absolute nonsense.
Yes, exactly. There were more than 20 generic manufacturers of hydroxychloroquine. And Peter Navarro, at Trump's behest, went around to some of the generic makers and got 50 or 60 million pills donated to the United States. So we actually had a surplus of the stuff. Those 50 million pills were not licensed, but they were placed in a stockpile. And those were the only hydroxychloroquine that actually had an EUA slapped on them by the FDA. And then they pretended that every hydroxychloroquine pill in America was under EUA and that they could impose restrictions on them because of that. So, yeah, now I think that that was part of the scam. I think that that claim was made very early, that the claim was that doctors were writing prescriptions and using it on their own families and depriving people who really needed it. That was the claim. Now, yes. I mean, yes, if you have lupus, you really need it. But if you have COVID, a life-threatening illness sometimes, you really need it also. Absolutely. You know, and to say that the lupus, and they got patients with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis to start writing letters, you know, to the editor and start complaining, we can't get our medicine because of these COVID fanatics. I think that was a scam as far as I can tell.
You know, I always share this. Let's finish with my little anecdote. It's a common anecdote that I say, but for me, one of my first red pill moments in COVID, remember me, I was naive New York Times reader, Fauci supporter. Well, not a Fauci supporter, but I didn't think he was a bad guy. But when I remember driving in my car, it was like March 2020, and I'm listening to the radio, and the radio announces that the FDA has restricted hydroxychloroquine to the hospitalized patient only. And I'm in my car, like banging on the dashboard. You morons, why would you restrict an early antiviral to 8 to 10 days into the disease? This is so stupid. I didn't say corrupt. I thought they were just stupid. I mean, this is all the chicanery around hydroxychloroquine, as you just illustrated, Meryl. But anyway, you guys are the best. Keep working. Your organizations are great. Global Health Project, Door to Freedom, Sovereignty Coalition, I know, is streaming this episode out. And we need you guys to be doing that work. You know, there's so many facets to this stuff. And you guys are on this front. And we just appreciate and support your work. And I hope our supporters do, too.
Ditto to what Dr. Corey said. If I may, if you will allow me just a shameless plug for our 4-year anniversary, Pierre.
Oh, Joyce!
Wait a second. Yeah, this is almost 4 years. Today is April 10th. So our first Zoom meeting was on April 5th. Mm-hmm. And that Zoom meeting was recorded and it was sent out with a press release on April 7th. And that was the first press release, the first video that the FLCCC ever put out before we were really even the FLCCC, Pierre, as you'll recall.
We were the frontline working group or something?
Frontline COVID-19 critical care working group. We were the consortium. We were the working group. But I bring this up because of several things that were said by Kat, Dr. Lindley tonight, and Dr. Nass, and of course our dear Pierre, that you have that when these things, possibly dangerous vaccines and other sort of things will happen in the future, maybe, there's really only one place to go. And exhibit A of that, Pierre, is that first video. We sent that out to so many national media outlets. And what that video was the Math Plus hospitalized protocol. We couldn't get published. It was roundly ignored. And when I say it's Exhibit A, it's because Dr. Corey led by Paul Merrick. Dr. Merrick, he was one of the first to put together that initial protocol. You and Dr. Maduri and Dr. Iglesias and Dr. Verone worked to finesse that. And we're sitting here 4 years later, and what we know is that that video contained everything any practitioner around the world would need to know about saving their critically ill patients, and no one would listen. We know that for 3 months after that video was put out by the FLCCC, 3 months later, Oxford University ran the recovery trial. They had to stop the trial early because the components, especially this corticosteroid component that was being used, the control group was dying. So they had to stop the trial, declare that basically the FLCCC's protocol was right 3 months ago. The WHO did not approve it until September.
Joyce.
What?
Joyce, you're bringing back like nightmares and memories. But your point, though, everything on that original protocol, and I think earlier, but we've never taken anything off. All of every component on that Math Plus for the critically ill hospitalized patient, that has just accumulated for its efficacy. That's number one. Number two, the PTSD that I'm getting listening to you is when we were trying to push that out, Joyce, what was the response we got from every media outlet, from everything? It was, show me the randomized controlled trial, and then I'll put it out there. You remember that, Joyce?
Yes. And when I argued with, I think it was someone from CNN, and I said, people are dying now. We don't have time to do a randomized controlled trial. And what I have to say is that the medical minds that we had, Pierre, Paul, Joe Verone, Jose Iglesias, Umberto Maduri, were some of the most brilliant, highly published, and accomplished in the world. They should have been the doctors that the public health agencies were looking to, but instead we were ignored to the detriment of the hundreds of thousands who died between the time we came out with the protocol and the WHO approved it in September. The UK, Yeah.
Drew, what you're saying there, you know, it's so commonsensical. And I think it's really Bobby Kennedy. I've heard of him in an interview. He's, you know, people ask him, what would you have done differently? And one of the things he said, he probably has 100 things to say, but he said, I would have brought the clinicians, the community clinicians together to share, you know, what they're doing, what they're seeing is working, and figure this out. And we had done that just intuitively. We were like a rapid response team, but we were shut down. No one listened to us. No one cared.
Exactly. Let
me jump in.
Yeah.
Joyce, you were not ignored. You were deliberately suppressed.
Yes.
Yeah.
We were.
Yeah.
We were. That's 100%.
You're so fun,
right.
Meryl. You're such enlightening messages all the time, Meryl.
but the reason I brought it up is because it has now become a cautionary tale. When Pierre said earlier, if these things are declared by the WHO or any other body, do not go anywhere else but the FLCCC website, because the medical minds we had then have been joined by more brilliant medical minds, two of which are joining us tonight, to continue this mission to save lives with what we know, with robust, rigorous, tested scientific evidence, what works. So I had to say that because only because what you said just, you know, it rests in my heart all the time. And I remember that first video and watching you testify on that video, which we put together in 2 days and sent out to the world, and which was roundly ignored, that Dr. Ness reminds me of, is that we are still the same organization today. 4 years later, here we are, committed to saving lives. And though COVID may be mostly in the rearview mirror, we have long COVID, we have long vax, we have a lot of other conditions of human health that we are ready to address with repurposed drugs and,
Joyce,
and yeah, what?
Bring on Disease X, we'll solve it.
Disease X.
But I just want to make a comment. You know, I've been kind of listening a lot and just kind of absorbing everything we're saying and watching ourselves on the Zoom. And I can't even believe that we are here, right?
Yeah.
I can't believe that medicine has come to this. You know, these doctors who have to meet on Zooms and come with protocols because, you know, the medical society, the science is ignoring their own duty. We have abandoned our duty as physicians. You know, when the first thing hit, we should have done what Pierre has done, and some of us have. And you know, you rush in, you figure things out, you try this, it doesn't work, you do that. But this whole thing that, like, you can't, you know, you say, like, what was your aha moment? Mine was when they said hydroxychloroquine is and azithromycin are causing cardiac issues.
Yeah,
I actually have given hydroxychloroquine to my rheumatoid arthritis patients forever. I put them on Z-Pack all the time. I never once said, oh, let's do an EKG. It's like we have abandoned our duty. You know, the trust has been broken. And I know we are trying to do our best we can to restore it. And we have been. But I just can't believe we're even here. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for reminding us of that, of how far we've fallen as, scientific community and medical system. I mean, I've long ago accepted that, and we fight here in these little pockets of resistance, but it is worth remembering that we were never this bad. I mean, it's completely disintegrated in COVID, and you know, there is a positive aspect to it, isn't that, and I speak for myself, is that that disintegration has exposed its faults, the scope and scale of its corruption, and the fact that it's not about our public health, and that we need to be very skeptical. And I think, for instance, a lot of our supporters and followers and viewers tonight, I think they realize that. But I think what you just said is really important, that it shouldn't be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. It could be different, but unfortunately, it's not.
It is not different. And I will say, those of you who are watching, and many, many thousands more who couldn't be with us tonight, if you've discovered the FLCCC and all that we have stood for the betterment of humanity, consider yourselves lucky. I am not a doctor. But I'm glad to say I was able to recognize instantly the brilliance of this team, which I said has only gotten more and more knowledgeable and instinctive about this and brilliant over the years. And so without COVID, we would not have been, I'm not blessing COVID, believe me, but without COVID, we would never have come into existence and ignited this movement with warriors like Kat and Meryl and so many others that are in the FLCCC orbit. I just think that anyone who's found the FLCCC has found help and healing and hope and compassion and caring and the soul of true healers, and that is human compassion. And so I can't thank you all enough, Kat and Meryl and Pierre. I adore you all and all of the other providers who have come into our orbit. I bless them as well. So thank you all so much. Thank you.
Let me just say that I used the FLCCC protocols, basically throughout COVID. And I was hesitant about using the steroids. It took me a while. I have to apologize to my patients. I didn't realize how important they were. But yes, you were it. FLCCC was the leader in how to manage this. And it's, we do need brave people like Pierre and Paul, who have lost their ability to practice in a normal setting, but they wouldn't want to practice in a normal setting. Same as me. I've lost mine too, because the normal setting now is not interested in your health. It's moving in lockstep with these government and globalist priorities. So thank God we have a small cadre of medical professionals who still remember their oath and remember that their responsibility is to the patient and not to the system. And I certainly, if I get my license back, I will be following the FLCCC protocols once more.
Long live the resistance, guys.
Yes. Well, again, thank you from the bottom of my heart to all of you who are here and all of you watching and around. So we do have a couple of announcements we'll get to. So we'll see you guys a little bit later. This was tonight a very timely topic. And we are so glad you were able to join us tonight for this really important and timely discussion. And as always, there's no shortage of great topics to dive into. So we wanted to share that the next 2 weeks' webinars, you really don't want to miss. Next Wednesday, neurologist extraordinaire, Dr. Suzanne Gazda, one of the FLCCC's superstar warriors, will join us for a discussion on COVID and your brain. And we will be sharing a new brain health guide as well. The following week, we're going to be joined by retired U.S. Air Force Major Thomas Haviland and embalmer Richard Hirschman, who was featured on the film Died Suddenly, for a discussion on what embalmers have seen and they continue to see, including large and fibrous clots. Ooh. Wow. So make sure to tune into both of those later this month. Well, as Kelly mentioned last week, I have stepped back from producing the FLCCC weekly news capsule, but fortunately, the team has come up with something really special to take the capsule's place. The creative team has put together a new weekly update called Highlights from the Healthcare Revolution to share insights, discussions, discoveries, and debates. So timely. So make sure to check that out on our FLCCC Alliance Substack, and please subscribe to our Substack too. The one and only Jenna McCarthy has shared a new Here's a Thought with us. This one is entitled, It'd Be Easier to Forgive You If You'd Apologize. Yeah, well said. It's about her deep desire for an apology from certain folks in her life, or rather different types of apologies from different folks in her life. I'm sure that after the last 4 years, we can all relate to that sentiment. So head over to our Substack or use the link on the screen to read Jenna's latest thoughts. And if you have any questions about health, treatments, or this, revolution as you've seen tonight, we find ourselves in, and you're interested in learning more, make sure to check out our Education on Demand, where you can watch all the lectures, panel discussions, and Q&As from February's conference in Phoenix. The content is free to view. However, we do ask for a donation only as you are able to help support the production costs associated with creating and sharing this life-saving information. You can learn more or start watching today at flccc.net/EOD. And with that, let's bring up our own Christina Morris, who's been busy tonight with answering all of your questions. Hey, Christina.
Hey, Joyce.
How are you tonight?
I'm great.
Are you busy or have you been busy?
It's been a little quiet tonight. We have mostly questions for Meryl and Kat and you guys. So yeah, it's been kind of a chill night, actually.
That's good. We need a chill night every now and then. I mean, that you can't pull away from the discussion because it pertains to all of us. And
Absolutely.
It was nice to learn that there are things that we can do to get involved in this fight. And there really isn't, that I can think of, a more important fight right now. So,
yeah.
But thank you, as always, for what you and the cadre of nurses that sit in for us on Wednesday nights do. We appreciate it so much. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. We'll talk to you. And dear FLCCC family, we cannot say it enough, so we'll say it again. Thank you all for your endless support, your generosity, your strength, your curiosity. We are so, so grateful to each and every one of you. We will see you next week, same time, same place. But first, watch a My Story from Pam Pesta, functional medicine and compounding pharmacist, who says, "The FLCCC is my silver lining." She'll tell you why in this My Story. Good night, everyone.
Hi, I'm Pam. I'm a functional medicine and compounding pharmacist, and I want to share my story as a thank you to my hero doctors and all of the people at the FLCCC Alliance. I recently wrote a newsletter entitled, "Did I Witness the Silver Lining of COVID?" which I sent to both past and present patients after attending the winter conference in Phoenix. And I'm still trying to unpack the emotions that flooded me throughout that weekend. It was my third FLCCC conference and the second one that I attended in person, but this one felt different. And in many ways, it was different. My best friend and colleague in this fight, Tanya and I, decided to bring our husbands along so they could see for themselves why we have developed such a passion around this crisis as we try to support so many people who are struggling as a result. We weren't too encouraged that they would get it, although we really hoped that they would at least understand us all a little bit better after hearing it from our heroes. The first highlight of the conference for us was Dr. Merrick's talk on how COVID didn't create a corrupt medical system, but rather exposed it to so many clinicians and patients in the traditional healthcare system. Then on day two, we heard and saw for ourselves the story of 16-year-old Callie, a patient of Dr. Corey's, as it was told by her mom. Dr. Corey had us all in tears with his display of raw emotion, but we were also left full of hope and confidence that Callie will make a full recovery and attend the college of her dreams. This difficult but inspiring talk was the aha moment for our guys, and now they do get it. The FLCCC is my silver lining, and none of us in this fight has to feel alone anymore. Although I may have lost friends, family, colleagues, and patients over these 4 years, I couldn't be more grateful for all of the courageous people I have met and now collaborate with, which has only been possible because of COVID. We are strong, we are growing stronger, and we are full of hope of what we can accomplish as a group. As a pharmacist, I never resonated with the pill for an ill mentality, and my goals were always patients over profit, despite working at a major pharmacy chain. With the brilliant leaders at the FLCCC Alliance bringing all of us like-minded clinicians together, I can finally say that I believe the best is yet to come. Thank you.
Your stories are powerful. They change hearts and minds. Share yours today. Send it in to my story at flccc.net.